You ready to expand your brain, Akshata?
Of course, of course.
Just expanded my body, now I'm ready to expand my brain.
Exactly, yeah. Straight from the gym into this podcast. Yeah, so usually when we record this, I find a book or like a single article to read and discuss, but I've compiled a bunch of articles and like studies about kind of the idea of power in the brain and how power affects the brain and kind of like the psychological cognitive implications of power. So we're just, me and Christian are just going to talk about that. And we have one of our friends as a guest here. It's you, bro.
Now, this is where I introduce myself.
Yeah.
Hey, everyone. My name is Parth. I'm a recent graduate of the George Washington University Economics Department, where I also studied international affairs. I'm excited to talk with my good friends today about power.
Yep. All right, let's begin.
Yeah. So the first kind of articles we found about these were the ones that Parth linked us, and they were interesting, but they kind of had some, you know, problems, as most pop science articles do. So I'm mainly looking at these first couple articles, the Discover Mag article that says power causes brain damage, and then the one in our document directly under that, power does not cause brain damage, which is a critique article that kind of breaks down the other one. But my main issue with kind of articles like these, other than just like the clickbait headline, is that they kind of simplify a really complicated topic into like a single thing. And, you know, most people aren't going to sit and read through all of the studies to like understand it. So it makes sense. It's going to be simplified, but it's kind of just a problem with pop science in general.
Mm-hmm. Is it worth giving a brief summary of the original article and maybe the response article?
Yeah. So the power causes brain damage article is, you know, despite its problems, it has some interesting stuff just like with the idea of what power does in the brain. A couple of the main things are that it impairs mechanisms of empathy. So they reference a study where like people will be like drawing the letter E on their forehead, and people who are in higher positions of power tend to draw it backwards. So like they'll draw it where it's accurate from their point of view, but not others' points of view. So that is, you know, extrapolated to see that people in positions of power have decreased levels of empathy. And other things like they're worse at identifying feelings in a picture, like of pictures of faces, and they're worse at mimicking body expressions. Another thing that they mentioned that I've looked at pretty frequently is this idea of mirroring. So there are these neurons in the brain called mirror neurons that activate in response to seeing other people doing actions. So there are lots of ideas on why these may have evolved and what they kind of do. But the main idea is that they're used for like empathy, to like mirror or mimic what others are doing and understand what they're doing, or like learning. So like if you see someone doing an action, you can learn it because those neurons are simultaneously firing. Those like the act of mirroring is decreased in people with higher levels of power, because if you show people with differing power levels a thing of someone like squeezing a tennis ball, the people with higher power levels will have less mirroring activity in the areas than the people with lower power levels. So those are some of like the neuroscience things. They also talk about how powerful people are more likely to think abstractly and think big picture over like consequences and like small details. They're more likely to downplay risks, have higher testosterone and lower cortisol, testosterone being associated with aggression, cortisol being associated with stress. And also people with more power are more likely to be hypocrites, in the sense that they are less tolerant of cheating when other people cheat, but given the opportunity to cheat and get ahead, they are more likely to cheat. And you know, it's not all bad. There was another study I looked at where it says that they did a study of like people who are more communal in nature versus people who are more exchange-based, in like, so the former associate power with like social responsibility and cooperation, and then the latter associate it with like being able to accomplish your interests. So they did a study with these people, and if you put someone who's communal in a position of power, they tend to be more pro-social, whereas if you put someone who's more exchange-related in a position of power, they tend to be more selfish. So there are a lot of these implications thrown out about articles, but some of them do have some problems methodologically speaking.
Yeah. And I think One of the first methodological problems to sort of talk about in a lot of these studies is the fact that a lot of them rely on something called priming, social priming, which is basically a technique whereby researchers will tell their subjects to think of an experience where they had a lot of power or to think of an experience where they had very little power and to use that temporary feeling of power in order to reach conclusions about how power affects the brain. And there are a lot of shortcomings associated with that. I mean, first of all, nobody knows whether this temporary form of power really translates into long-term neurological changes associated with holding power over the long-term, because it's very possible that given enough time, your brain might get used to the amount of power that you're accustomed to wielding, and maybe there are interesting consequences related to that. Another issue is that there could be a bias introduced on the part of the researchers who are hoping for some sort of outcome, and they might project that onto their research subjects. So for a variety of reasons, these priming studies, and there's also a crisis in replication associated with them as well. So for a lot of reasons, it's good to take these studies with a grain of salt.
Yeah, 100%. What you said about kind of these transitory changes in power is completely accurate, because a lot of these studies, you can't actively give people more power than other people in an experimental setting, because that raises ethical issues a lot of the time. So they use these transitory priming effects for power. And priming is a thing in psychology and like social science a lot. Like just in general psychological research, priming is a used tool. So like an example I've seen before is if you prime people with age-related words, like related to like older people or like, grandparents, or just words related to age, and then you have them do like a detection task, there you will see a significant decrease in like the speed of their detection. And that's just like one example. Also, like if you prime people with things about animals and have them do a word search, they're going to find clues, like words related to animals, more like quickly than before. So priming is like used a lot in social science, but power priming and like priming with regards to like feeling powerful are kind of contested in certain places. Like there was the whole thing about power posing that happened a few years ago, mm-hmm. where like if you pose a certain way before a meeting or something, it should give you more confidence. And there's been a lot of back and forth on all of these studies. So like you said, there's like been a replication crisis in a lot of these areas.
Yeah, it did. Well, I was reading one study from 2010 that found that power poses do have some tangible effect on hormone levels. So I think there may be something. I don't think priming is necessarily invalid as a tactic altogether in research. My greater critique is mostly with the longevity of the results, whether they hold up in the long run.
Yeah, 100%. And like the other thing is, the article title, like Power Causes Brain Damage, one of the critiques of that is that, brain damage is something we generally think of as, permanent or like fixed. And like saying that the implication there is that, having power leads to levels of brain activity and behaviors that are similar to brain activity and behaviors that are associated with brain damage. And the implication there is that power causes brain damage, which is a leap of logic to make in and of itself, but it ends up happening a lot in pop science articles.
Yeah, it definitely would have lost me some points on the LSAT.
You have any thoughts, Christian, so far?
I think Parth has covered like a significant amount of it. I will say that when it comes to priming, it's not I would argue that it's not merely like priming about power that oftentimes gets scrutinized. It's priming as like a field and as a tactic that oftentimes gets scrutinized by like research today. And I think that's like a phenomenon in psychology that's really happened within like the past like 5 years. Like power posing, the woman, one of the scientists who, first came up with the idea of power posing, she had a very famous TED talk, I think like around probably sometime between like 2010 and 2015. And now like that particular TED talk has come underneath a lot of fire because it turns out that like the idea of power posing doesn't really replicate, right? And that's all coming from science from like the past like five, maybe like at best 10 years. So I would say like the critique of priming is broader than that, like than how it merely like applies to power itself.
Yeah. And I think something that Parth mentioned earlier, the idea of how like experimenter effects could have affected some of these priming studies. Many of these studies have been shown to like not be fully double blind or like not even fully like replicable. I read a specific experiment they did to look at these studies, where that they did like a classic power priming study, but they did it with a computer where people were randomly like assigned by a computer to be in a high power group or a low power group. So the high power group was told that they were the boss in a situation and had like an additional task to complete. And then the low power group was told they were an employee and the boss had assigned them a specific responsibility. These responsibilities were same for both groups. So they were doing the same thing. It's just one group was primed to be in a position of power and one wasn't. And they all did their task. And then they did this independent task called the flanker test, which has in the past been shown to be affected by power priming. But when they did it with this computer method, there was no real difference in the high power group versus the low power group. And they went back in and they did another experiment where they did the same thing, but the experimenters, like the people running the experiment to the participants, were told which group that the participants were supposed to be in, either high power or low power. But when the participants got to the computer, that would only be correct like half the time. So the experimenters were led to believe that they knew which group that the subjects were going to be in, even when they actually weren't. And then they did the experiment again, and the participants were also able to like rank social attributes of their experimenters, like were they friendly, were they competent, were they trustworthy, and a bunch of other like social factors. And they did this experiment again, and the results there, they showed that the participants' performance in this test that was previously influenced by like power priming is more influenced by how the experimenters treat them than their power group. So the way that their experimenters kind of deferred to them if they were in the high power group might have given the participants some kind of cue as to what group they were in, and that affected the results more than specifically being told they were in the high power group or the low power group. So that's pretty interesting, this idea that like how people treat you when they believe you have power could be in and of itself more like effective to how your tasks go than like actually being told or feeling that you have power yourself. So that was like a specific experiment that was kind of critiquing these like priming studies.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's definitely something I've run into in the past. I think the first time I ever heard of an anecdote related to experimenter expectations was with, I think, rats running a maze. And I think the experimenter in the study basically put up a bunch of signs that said this group of rats is smart, like treat them, or he didn't even give them any directions on how to treat them. He just said, these rats are smart, these rats are dumb, let them run a maze. And even though they were identical rats from an identical population, from an identical pool of rats just bought for this experiment, for whatever reason, the quote unquote smarter rats ended up running the maze quicker. And that was because the experimenters treated them with more compassion or this and that, you know, rewarded them or whatever. And it's just interesting how experimenter expectations can lead to such a gap in outcomes.
Yeah, which is why it's important for, experience, in particular, psychological experiments like the ones we're talking about today should be double blind, right? Where the experimenters and the experimented, or I guess experimentees, don't really like know
participants,
each other.
Participants? Subjects?
Yeah, participants? No. We got to use English to its fullest extent. The experimenters and the experimentees aren't really like aware of one another, right? I think that's like part of like the one of the larger like revolutions in like psychology, like within the past decade or so, as like the ramifications of the replication crisis have sort of come to light.
That's basically like kind of an overview of like what people say and like what kind of pop science says that power is and how it affects the brain. But I found a couple studies that looked into like deeper like theories of power and how it kind of works from either a neurological perspective or like a social science perspective. So one of the main ones is this idea of the activation inhibition theory of power. These rest on like two systems in the brain. And you see this a lot with like neuroscience and cognitive science, where you have like two diametrically opposed systems working to like create a phenomenon. And the two systems in this case are the behavioral acting system and the behavioral inhibition system. The behavioral acting system is kind of like a dopamine system in the brain that makes you like act and do things. So it's about like motivation and like actively doing things. The inhibition system is like inhibiting behavior and avoidance of threat. It's not necessarily for like inhibiting behavior that is like extraneous to a goal or anything. It's not like controlled inhibition, which is actually controlled by the first system. It's about like stopping to check if there are threats around and like looking for danger and gathering information. So those are the two systems in this. And, you know, it's been shown by some of these studies that powerlessness, so like the act of not having power, the situation of not having power, is associated with less activity in the behavioral activating system. And power is associated with more activity in the behavioral activating system. But a lot of these things show that we need more study to kind of see how both of these systems affect it. Is it like an increase in one and a decrease in the other or something like that? Like what that balance is there? And one of the things in one of the interviews that I looked at by a neuroscientist, he talked about how these systems aren't like permanent really. And this goes back to what Parth was saying earlier. Like, I think the quote from this neuroscientist talked about, like, if you're in like a middle management position, half the time when you're interacting with people, you're in a place of power because you're interacting with subordinates. Half the time you're not because you're interacting with your managers. So both of these systems kind of change over time. And there's kind of neuroscience to back this up. It's been shown before that dopaminergic activity in the prefrontal cortex is associated with like the value of an action and like how much we like value something versus noradrenergic activity signals like the psychological cost of doing something. So if powerful people have more behavioral activating system activity, they have more dopamine activity. So they care more about the value and the kind of outcome of an action compared to its psychological cost. So that's one of the main theories is this activation inhibition theory of power.
Yeah, another priming study from 2013 on university undergraduates found that individuals imbued with higher power were less likely to recall goal-hindering information relative to goal-facilitating information when given hypothetical scenarios about like creating a flower business or going to the Amazon for a vacation than people in low power who are more likely to recall goal-hindering information because they were more reluctant to act, I guess, in a sense.
Right, right.
You
can go ahead.
Okay, I was just going to say like another form of decisive action is from a study from Galinsky, who shows up a lot in power literature from 2003, so a little bit, maybe out of date. But it showed that people who are primed to feel powerful are more likely to take decisive action, like shutting off a noisy fan, for example. So just exactly. Like another,
them being what would an indecisive action be?
Just letting the fan go off. Yeah, I saw that study as well. Like they were in like a waiting room and they there was like an annoying fan in the waiting room and those primed with like a higher sense of power are more likely to just like shut off the fan instead of just like dealing with it.
And then presumably random odds would dictate.
Mm-hmm. Hopefully. yeah, another name and kind of idea that shows up a lot in like more deep theories of what power is this idea that power increases abstract thinking. So a study by Pamela Smith, who is often showing up in power research, shows that there's this bi-directional link between abstract big picture thought and power. So basically thinking in an abstract sense can prime you to feel more powerful, and reversely being primed with power can cause you to think in a more abstract way. And this shows up like very frequently in a lot of research is that people in positions of power seem to have like a bigger picture view of their environment and think in more abstract terms, less concrete terms, and care less about small details rather than kind of the overall scheme of what they're looking at. And I think this idea of how like language affects power is really interesting as well. There's also another study in this vein that talks about how abstract language is also a cue for signaling power. So not only does like abstract language influence feelings of power and feelings of power influence abstract language, using abstract language can be a cue to other people in your environment that make them perceive you as more powerful. So this idea of like abstraction and power, they're like pretty intimately linked. And I found that very interesting.
Or at least the researchers like claim, right? I did. Mm-hmm. So reading the Pamela Smith study, which I think was from around 2006, I did have like a lot of skepticism about like her and her colleagues' like methodology. What her team did was they essentially ran like a series of four experiments. They tried to, you know, essentially test like this bi-directional causality between abstract thinking and the sense of feeling powerful, not necessarily power itself, but like, you know, one's self-perception of power. And yeah. Most of these experiments that they ran, you know, for one thing, they're being run on like very young people, which is like a pretty common critique with psychological experiments, is that they're run on college students.
Grad students.
Grad students in, you know, Western educated, individualistic, rich countries, which is in itself, you know, its own critique that, you know, most of these studies are being conducted on, you know, so-called weird people. So there's that. The gender ratio of like the studies were kind of skewed. Also, I just thought that like statistically speaking, like the studies themselves were somewhat underpowered. Like there were a lot of like 0.05 p-values, and like in terms of like the number of participants, there are maybe like around like 100 participants, right? And I think if you're trying to measure something, you know, like abstract thinking and its relationship to power, you know, we already know that like social priming or like priming in psychology is itself like a little bit suspect. I'm just like not sure if like the link is quite as strong as like, you know, the study in question purports it to be. What I did find a little bit more convincing was the sort of like link between abstract language as a cue for power, because I do think a lot of times like people, at least here in the United States, they tend to ignore politicians who speak in like sort of like concrete details and whatnot. Like, you know, we prefer our politicians to be aspirational. So I think the research there to me was like a little bit more convincing, even though at the same time, looking at like the number of participants in the study, I also think that like those studies were also a little bit underpowered because the ends were usually around like 30 participants. Maybe I think the maximum number of participants in one of the experiments for the abstract language as a cue was maybe like 130. And like in like the stats that they were doing, you know, these sort of like ANOVA, so like these categorical variables, there's like a lot of like potential noise in there. So yeah, I just wanted to, you know, make that comment about, you know, that a lot of these studies, you know, aren't particularly strong, you know, and that we should be very careful about like how we interpret them.
Christian, I think you're referring to a different 2006 study that related to abstraction and power. I think the Pamela Smith one is from 2014, but it definitely has the same like sample selection issues. Like I think they used Amazon's Mechanical Turk, and they similarly had sample sizes of about 100 people, horribly gender skewed toward males, very low age. So I think a lot of your critiques definitely still hold up.
I'm actually talking about both.
Oh, okay.
I was talking about both. So like in the 2006 one, I think the gender ratio was actually skewed towards females. And then maybe in like the other one that did use MTurk, it might've been like skewed towards males. But I mean, I do think both of them were very, just in terms of like sample selection, you know, they were very sus.
Yeah, I will say if the abstraction research does hold up though, I think it has a lot of interesting implications for like the business world. I think like a lot of power studies are published in like business related journals because I think that's something that's interesting to them. But like, you know, if even using abstract language can like imbue people with a sense of power, I think that explains a lot of like the like race to the bottom in terms of like using corporate jargon and like sort of vaguer language like synergy and this and that, instead of maybe getting into the nitty gritty and actually explaining how, you know, your firm is going to increase productivity or whatever. Because I mean, people's individual perceptions of power are probably more important to them than you know, maybe the output, which is sort of the responsibility of the whole team. So, I mean, it wouldn't surprise me if that was part of the contributing phenomenon to that.
Yeah, I think, you know, anecdotally speaking, the idea of like, I know at least in like therapy settings, when you're having like specific details and, you know, specific occurrences that you're talking about, it gives a sense of power in a way to like map those two like general words or abstract concepts, like calling something like repression or calling something avoidance, which is a more abstract thing than like your specific details of day to day, can give you a greater sense of like power over your actions. So like anecdotally speaking, it tracks that using more abstract language that isn't as focused on details and more part of a bigger picture can give you like a greater sense of control. But you know, again, that's anecdotally speaking. I haven't run any studies. Yeah, another study that like also a Pamela Smith one, but one I like went into much more deeply is this idea of like the non-conscious cues, like the non-conscious effects of power. So basically the main thing I found really interesting with this is that people are really good at detecting other people's power levels, like based on nonverbal cues, like how powerful another person is in a situation compared to yourself and like how much power you have in a situation. People are really good at detecting that unconsciously, but they're really bad at figuring out the specific cues that give you that information. Like people will think that like a specific verbal thing or a specific nonverbal tick is a signal of power when it actually isn't. And this kind of runs into this whole idea of how, you know, power perception, a lot of it happens non-consciously. And it, you know, makes it interesting to think of like, you know, usually when we think of people who are powerful, we think of them having like intentionality. And of course they have intentionality in a sense, but a lot of power processing happens, you know, automatically, non-consciously, especially because a lot of it comes from, you know, body language and nonverbal cues, most of which are interpreted just like automatically in the brain. So that makes sense that we wouldn't consciously have access to the parts of our brain that are doing that processing. And it also makes like evolutionary sense why you would want an automatic way to detect power. Like evolutionarily speaking, if you're in a social situation where you have less power, you don't want to make like a social faux pas or like offend the person you're with. So non-consciously, it would make sense to have a way to accurately and quickly be able to determine that, which is what these studies appear to show, is that people are very quick at figuring out what the power levels are, but not very quick at knowing why they think that.
Yeah, for sure. That's definitely one of the most fascinating findings related to this field. I think, I mean, maybe related to that, like when you do have power, maybe part of the reason for not necessarily immediately recognizing or being able to empathize with people and sort of recognizing what they're feeling is because there's a bit of like a stress buffer that powerful people tend to exhibit. At least a 2015 study from like some researchers at like Harvard and Stanford found that like powerful people tend to be associated with lower levels of like cortisol and higher testosterone, which like combine to reduce fear and stress. And so like they sort of have a bit of a buffer in stressful situations.
Yeah, 100%. Like if you're in a situation where you have power over people, making a mistake isn't really going to be horrible for you. So you're okay with, you know, either making a mistake or having a social faux pas. But if you're not powerful, that could cause like, I guess, like ostracism or some kind of social cost. So people who are more powerful tend to have lower stress. I also, a lot of these, I don't know, I feel like it's worth noting that like in our society, people who are powerful also tend to have wealth. And if you have wealth, you're going to have less stress just overall because you're in a wealthier position. So there are a bunch of confounding variables there as well that, I don't know, sometimes I feel like science studies forget to talk about. Like there was a study I looked at that looked at size differences in like, you know, like a lot of CEOs are tall, a lot of famous politicians are tall or whatever like that. So, you know, and a lot of them are men. And the study was talking about how like, you know, there are like psychological and evolutionary factors. And like, you know, obviously we all know that there are social factors as well, but they're sometimes just not even mentioned in science studies.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And, you know, along with like the idea of all these confounding factors, I'm not sure if like the article that like Parth mentioned was making a causal claim, but there's like this issue of reverse causality, right? Where, right. You know, instead of like powerful people experience less stress, it might be that people who experience less stress naturally are more likely to end up in positions of power because they can handle that stress.
This is the study was making just a pure case about association.
Mm, yeah. So like, you know, like that, like central problem for risk causality, I think is like very important.
Yeah.
Because, you know, it's not like, you know, Akshata, you mentioned about how, you know, people in position power, for example, like CEOs, they tend to be men or a better example would be like, they tend to be like taller than the general population. It's not like getting into that position of power made them taller, right?
Right.
So it's a similar thing with, you know, like the levels of cortisol and testosterone.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
If only you can find that instrumental variable.
Yeah. And then I keep drawing from this article because it like kind of summarizes a lot of things from previous articles. And it mentioned that power does kind of three things. It increases abstraction, which we talked about, increases approach, which is like, you know, approaching a situation, which we kind of talked about with the activation inhibition theory of power. And it also increases goal direction and attention to internal states. So we talked about goal direction and how people in positions of power tend to be more directed towards their own goals. And, you know, it's been shown that people with less power have decrements in executive functioning. So like focusing on a goal and accomplishing those goals. And they have a harder time parsing out irrelevant information to achieve their current goals. It also talked about, with regards to the goal orientation, powerful people tend to do this process of objectification a lot. So they tend to treat people and resources as like a means to a goal or like a means to an end, rather than like considering things from their perspective. And, you know, all of this kind of seems bad, but also this study talked about how if you assign a goal to like people in a workplace who have more power and you make that goal, like making the workplace more welcoming, making it more comfortable, those people will take a greater effort to like learn about their subordinates and like remember details about them as well. So kind of picking a goal that is more cooperative can mitigate some of these effects. And also another interesting like pro, I guess, that they noted was that higher power people are more likely to forgive like mistakes and transgressions in a relationship because they're more tied to like the goal of maintaining the relationship than momentary hurt feelings. So there are like these negative things of that power and like being very goal oriented can be related to, but apparently there are also these positive things.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah. And then, so I mentioned goal orientation. And the other thing was this magnification of attention to your internal states. So you're more tied to and like influenced by your own internal states than you are by the external world. So this kind of makes sense from what we were talking about earlier, that powerful people are less attentive to others, because there's obviously the fact that they don't need to be. They have this buffer of like not really needing to pay attention to other people because they have power. But also it means that they care less about like the situation around them and more their own goals and their more internal, their own internal states. So this is seen by an increased correspondence between internal traits and behaviors. So if you, this was a thing where if you put someone in a communal orientation in a position of power, they will show more generosity and they will, you know, be more cooperative. If you put someone with an exchange mindset who more thinks in terms of like outcomes and goals and like self-interest in a position of power, they will tend to be more selfish in that position of power. So it's kind of this weird thing where like your own internal state is a certain thing, and then giving you power makes you more likely to stick to whatever your own internal state was beforehand.
Mm-hmm. So one of the implications that I'm getting from what you're saying, Akshata, is about the importance of norms. For example, yeah. you mentioned how like, you know, this explicit goal orientation of powerful people can actually be a plus if the goals that they're pursuing are like somehow like pro-social, right? And that in essence, like depends on the cultivation of a particular norm. Like whether that be a directive from like a higher up, or in like my preferred example, considering like our political moment, whether it's like broader political and cultural norms. So that's what I'm getting from there. Like, is that like norms are like very important to sort of help mitigate the bad effects of power.
Norms or even rules, I guess. Like, you know, if one of your rules is that the workplace has to be a diverse place or a welcoming place, then hopefully it would still encourage that same sort of pro-social behavior.
Yeah, but I think Akshata might have like mentioned this earlier, but there's also like a phenomenon amongst powerful people where they're more likely to experience hypocrisy, right? Where they're more willing to like allow themselves to bend the rules for, you know, their own goals. So I definitely think that rules are definitely important, but so is sort of like these like basic norms of like what goals should be.
Yeah, I guess you have to take ownership of those goals to some extent as well.
Yeah. I think just like Parth said, a lot of this comes from like business articles or like people doing studies in business. And, you know, the main goal in all of that is profit. So you're not going to have, you know, it takes a lot of restructuring to kind of center something on cooperation or like pro-social values. It takes a considerable effort to like make those goals as important as the goal for profit.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, and like this sort of like, maybe not like profit, but like the idea of like pure self-interest is not only like something that's applicable to business itself, but also just sort of like broader social phenomena, for example, like politics. For example, there's an entire field of economic thought called public choice theory that basically attempts to predict the actions of economic actors and political actors based off of the like sole idea that they're self-interested. And while that's taken as a norm within like the public choice field, that's not necessarily like the norm that has to exist, right? It's something that can be changed.
Yeah, so all of these things we talked about that can kind of affect power or cause power or kind of interplay with power on a deeper level. One of the theories I looked at that kind of tried to explain all of these and combine all of these is this idea of the social distance theory of power. It explains a couple of things that aren't really explained by the avoidance or the activation inhibition theory of power. So it's based on this part of social science called construal level theory, which has this concept of psychological distance. So kind of the definition I found is that psychological distance is defined as the extent to which something or someone is perceived or experienced as far away from the self here and now. So it's kind of this idea in our psychology of how distant something is from us, either spatially or temporally or like hypothetically or like just in like a broad sense, like how distinct something is from us. So construal level theory says that psychological distance increases abstraction. So the further away something is from you, the more abstractly you're gonna view it, which, you know, ties into a lot of these things that we were talking about with power. And in this theory, they call it social distance instead of psychological distance because it's about a social field, but it's about, you know, it talks about how like the higher power person in a situation has more social distance from the people around them, not social distance in like a corona sense, but in like a psychological sense where
Can I ask a question for a second?
Yeah.
So you mentioned about how like article authors were talking about how a greater amount of social distance helps predict like a greater level of extraction of thought of other groups, right?
Mm-hmm.
So do the authors mention stereotypes at all? If you're thinking about other groups in terms of abstractions, are you also thinking about them in terms of stereotypes?
100%, yeah. A couple of studies I looked at, I don't remember which ones in specific, mention how specifically people in higher power situations, because they're thinking more abstractly and not worrying about details, or like this is the logic in the papers, they're using stereotypes because it avoids having to look at details and they can rely on past experience and past heuristics to make a judgment. So it avoids this need of looking into the details and preserves this kind of just way of looking at it abstractly and being more goal focused. So stereotypes definitely come into this. And, you know, this social distance theory explains like a lot of things that we've talked about before, like the idea that higher power individuals have behavior that aligns more with their internal values. Values are, you know, abstract concepts. And if you are more inclined, if you have more psychological distance, if you have more social distance from the people in your environment, you're probably going to think more abstractly and you're going to be more tied to your values. These are the types of logic that's used in the study. It also mentions objectification, which, you know, the idea of objectification is not really explained by activation inhibition theory, but it is kind of explained with social distance theory. And so with more social distance, you don't really see people as people in a sense, you see them more as objects. And then, you know, goal-directed action also-
some might say.
As the other, exactly. Goal-directed action also makes sense with this theory in the sense that goals are long-term and abstract. So with more psychological distance from your environment, you're going to be more inclined to look at the abstract. So it makes sense in a way, like a lot of these psychological theories I've seen at least, they try and explain gaps in other theories. So, you know, the activation inhibition theory, social distance theory, I'm sure like the real idea of what power is, whatever we want to consider that as, is like a combination or a melding of different parts of different theories. But it's interesting to see like where different theories put their emphasis and how they cover this, you know, type of field.
This is a complete aside, but this kind of reminds me, I don't know why this reminds me of this, but you know, the clip from the Eric Andre show about Margaret Thatcher?
Yes.
I'm just thinking, do you think Margaret Thatcher was effectively a goal-oriented person by funneling money into illegal paramilitary death camps in Northern Ireland?
I mean, there was a goal.
Yeah.
It was directed.
That is very true. I mean, I find this idea of social distance, for one thing, I find it fairly compelling. But another thing is, like, I find it, like, very interesting as an exploration of, you know, just sort of, like, political issues and things like that. You know, in a time of polarization, when you're evaluating the people on the other side of the political aisle, you're more likely to rely on, stereotypes and levels of extraction. right? Like, for example, I think a lot of people who would lean somewhat left, in, like underneath the American standard of left here, a lot of people who like lean left in America would oftentimes maybe like stereotype Trump supporters as like white working class or something like that. But as the sort of like recent Capitol riots have shown, it's a much more like complex picture, right? Like,
you're dating this podcast.
I mean, absolutely. I mean, what are we if not creatures of our time?
Hey, we'll probably get some new Capitol riots in a week. So it'll be
evergreen. In a week, bro, we're going to get them in 3 days.
Oh my God. About? Continue dating exactly when this was recorded so that when it's released.
No, under the Biden administration, Capitol riots will happen every week on Saturday.
Oh, you're right. A weekly storming of the Capitol. But, you know, my point is that, like, a lot of these, while a significant portion of them are white, like, a lot of these people were not, you know, what we'd call, quote, unquote, like, white working class, right? Like, there are some people who came there on private jets, for example. A lot of people on there, you know, had MBAs, you know, very elite degrees, to these senators who... I'm not going to say implicated in the Capitol riots, but are certainly like associated with the Capitol riots a little bit in the public mind today. Josh Hawley and Ted Cruz are, you know, very elite people with elite degrees from, I think they're both Yale graduates, I believe.
Ted Cruz is Princeton, Harvard, and Josh Hawley is Yale Law School.
Oh, yes. You know.
Yeah.
Cream of the crop.
In class.
Oh, yeah. But I mean, my point is that, like, you know, for a lot of people, like, the realization that, you know, some of these people are also like Trump supported, it's sort of like a blind spot in some of the narratives that are being constructed about like Trump and his supporters, you know.
That's definitely valid, yeah, for sure.
Yeah. And then of course, like the same thing happens on the left as on the right as well, where there's this thing called in-group out-group homogeneity, where people perceive people in the out-group as essentially being all the same. And there's this one guest on Rush Limbaugh's radio show, and he was basically saying, the basic claim was that, you know, all the people on the left, so like all the members of the Democratic Party, Biden, AOC, you know, that entire like coalition of politics, like they all more or less think the same.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Everybody, you know, left to center, like essentially, you know, acts the same. And people who, you know, exist there know for a fact that that is absolutely not true. If you simply go on Twitter at the current moment, there are these discussions about $1,400 check versus $2,000 checks, you know? So, I mean, it's just something that to me, you know, strikes as very like interesting that we're so reliant on stereotypes to sort of like inform sort of like our lay understanding of how politics operates in the present.
Yeah. I think that's like a perfect segue into these ideas of like evolutionary psychology. So I'm drawing from a study that talks about evolutionary leadership theory and kind of its assumptions and what it's about. And the kind of assumptions that evolutionary leadership theory is based on is the idea that humans develop these like psychological rules or heuristics to kind of increase their survival and reproduction in like proto-societies and like ancestral human societies. And a lot of these are automatic, not conscious, and you gain these kind of heuristics that were once useful to survival, but now because the environment has so rapidly changed in the past couple thousand years, that these strategies are no longer useful. And in the study, they use the term mismatch, and these mismatches cause a lot of the like issues with like leadership in the era. And like, so that's one assumption. And the other assumption is that the idea of like leadership followership evolved to solve recurrent problems. So, you know, this isn't like immediately tied to power, but the idea that like, you know, why do people have, you know, people who have power are like leaders in society, like politicians or like leaders in like a workplace. So it's worth looking at the idea why this kind of system of leadership / followership might have evolved. So one of the assumptions there is that, you know, they define leadership as the coordination of the actions of two or more individuals to accomplish joint goals. And you would need this in like a proto-society for group movement. So like if you need to move your people to a place, to a resource, or to get food, you need to be able to coordinate them. Leadership can follow simple rules, like simple heuristics, like the person you see move first, you move along with them. So like, you know, there are lots of animal kind of examples of leadership as well, where like, I think one of the ones was like, for like elephants, like when they're like traveling to like an older watering hole, they'll follow like the oldest matriarch because she remembers where it was because she's the oldest. So this is like a, so this is, you could abstract this into a general rule, like follow people who are older or more experienced. And you know, these like logistical heuristic rules could help with conflict resolution, could help with leading in warfare for proto-human societies, could help in teaching, promoting social cohesion. So, you know, leadership could have evolved as like a system to be super beneficial in our early societies. One thing that was noted that was really interesting to me was that leadership in like proto-societies was generally based on just like charisma and like personal influence and like being able to like make nice with the people in your clan or whatever. And they call that weak leadership. The modern context of strong leadership, which is like associated with like power and coercion and like formalized like structures of like keeping people in charge, that is pretty recent. It's honestly very recent compared to kind of this long human history of like soft or weak leadership.
We actually talked a lot about this in sociocultural anthropology, which is a class that I took a few semesters ago, about like the different forms of organization, about the spectrum of power from influence to authority to power, and how, you know, the earliest forms, like under foraging societies, we tended to organize in bands led by leaders who generally exercised mostly influence, a bit of authority, and no real power, because the leader was essentially just the first among equals. And over time, as human group sizes grew, we shifted more toward formal power and away from sort of informal influence.
Right. Yeah. Evolutionary leadership theory is pretty interesting because the study itself tries to tie it in with like developmental biology and anthropology, like you said. And like, there was a thing in that study where they connected it to like evolutionary game theory, like the idea that like genes for leadership, of course, there's not just like a leadership gene, but like the trait of leadership and the trait of followership can stabilize in an equilibrium to where both of them are present and like actively in the system. And then, you know, it also tied in behavioral economics, where it talked about in like coordination games, pro-social personality types are more likely to emerge as leaders than selfish personality types. And, you know, evolutionary leadership theory, like the introduction to this entire article was talking about like ways you could match, you know, the evolutionary way that leadership emerged to other theories in the field.
Yeah, I mean, that makes a lot of sense, at least with like the sort of pro-social behavior. Like the earliest leaders were among the most generous people in their bands or in their groups or in their tribes, because they would be responsible for doling out, you know, loot, or for ensuring that like, you know, they could have enough buy-in to keep their position of power. So that doesn't surprise me. That makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, I think, you know, that kind of segues into this idea of like mismatch, where like ancient ways that leadership could have evolved counter the ways that leadership is kind of used in the modern era. So this study looked at like anthropological and like old data about like, you know, proto-societies and ancestral humans. And it also looked at current hunter-gatherer societies in like Southern Africa, in Tanzania, in Paraguay. So they looked at current hunter-gatherer societies that you could maybe mirror into the past, into these older societies. And they kind of came to the conclusion that older forms of leadership, like we said, are based more on like influence and charisma, but also it was a lot more fluid in the sense that like, you know, you would, if you were a leader in these older societies, you would be leading for one task, like either hunting or like foraging or whatever. And that would change based on what task we were doing and like what area we were in and who knows that area. So leadership in those societies is more fluid and distributed and situational compared to now. So like the person in those societies, the person most qualified for the task would have the most kind of influence. And then once that, you know, once they were in a different place or doing something different, someone else would take over or something. But now we kind of have, you know, one leader or one manager in like workplace settings who like oversees most of it. And it's like it's a top-down hierarchy instead of like a bottom-up, like distributed type hierarchy where like, you know, whoever's most qualified in the moment is in charge. And then that changes from time to time. That's much different from like a lot of workplace settings where like you have the person in charge and they pick the people below them that are in charge of the people below them. And so there's like that mismatch there between how it used to be in like ancestral human sense and how it kind of is now.
I wonder if that sort of fluid form of leadership might bear out the results of some of these priming studies a little bit more, because there, like leadership is a lot more temporary in those settings, as leadership is more temporary in these priming studies. And we have a fair amount of documentation on people like the Juwasi who are still hunter gatherers who live in southern Africa. I wonder if like the the anthropological research on them sort of bears out the results of these priming studies.
I thought that was really interesting, because like one of the implications of that is that like if you create like an organizational system in like a workplace where subordinates have more say in selecting who is a leader, then it could tend to have better effects in terms of like, I guess, morale and like productivity as well. But, you know, the way that modern organizational systems are currently organized is not very conducive to making that a thing that happens.
Work of cooperatives, Christian?
Yeah.
If it works for Publix, you know, Publix is a great store.
Indeed. Yeah, no, another mismatch they talk about is like physical posturing. So like, in proto-societies, leadership would often involve either hunting or warfare or defending, and like leaders would be like in the front, like doing the action or whatever. So this would select for leaders that have better health, are taller, are larger, everything like that, which is not super necessary now in like corporate environments. But you still see this propensity for taller people, for men, for bigger people to get into leadership positions. So that's one thing that the study talked about, which is a way to bring in evolutionary leadership theory. I talked about this before, but like this was the whole thing with like also like women have been barred from leadership for a really long time. So like it's not just like an evolutionary thing to think about, but it definitely brought in an evolutionary perspective onto why like physicality is seemingly a significant factor in leadership.
Yeah, and I even think like the idea of like, you know, leaders should be tall. I think it also applies to women as well, right? Like we generally expect like, again, if a woman is like a CEO, we generally expect her to be like taller than like average. Is that true or?
I don't know if that's true. I'm not sure. I might've heard that like it's not a significant result, but like anecdotally, mm-hmm. It makes sense. But you know.
Yeah. Of course, it could be that, you know, like when we're looking at women leaders, we're the things that we're evolutionary selecting for are going to be different than what we're evolutionary selecting for in men, right? Because theoretically, or at least like underneath my like layman's understanding, like if we're adopting this sort of like situational leadership model of like hunter-gatherer societies, women are more likely to specialize in different things than men, right? Where, you know, that idea of like tall physicality might not be as important. But when you translate that into like the idea of like a CEO, because the idea of a CEO is culturally tied to the idea of a man, when we look for like women CEOs, we might be looking for like masculine traits within like the woman, right? And so like in that sense, we might select for taller women.
No, yeah, I think I don't remember which study it was, but it mentioned how like modern ideas of leadership are very like masculine in the sense, mm-hmm. like what people generally associate with masculine traits, like ambition and like whatever. There was this idea that like, if you kind of unpack that and look at more whatever traditionally feminine traits are, I hate all of this language in all of these studies, but like the idea of like cooperativity and like being more nurturing, quote unquote, or whatever, you would see a form of leadership that is more like, I guess, feminine in nature, was an interesting thing that one of these studies said. But it's the idea that like, because leadership in a modern sense is so geared towards masculine, you get leaders that aren't as cooperative because cooperativity isn't a valued trait in men as much. So that's another instance of where there's like a mismatch there, where like, and something that might evolutionarily have been beneficial in the past is kind of a mismatch there where it's not as useful now.
Yeah, I will say, Christian, I really do buy into your idea that like even in women, it's like the masculine, quote unquote, masculine traits that are selected for. I mean, even in like foraging societies, like I mean, women were basically expected to still demonstrate like a high degree of physicality. And at least like in historical examples of like, you know, women as leaders of states, like at a time when leaders would still head into battle, like women who did head states would still be expected to go into battle, you know, and then a lot of times like they rose to their positions by virtue of their prowess in battle as well.
Yeah. I think another interesting thing is this idea of like charisma, and like I think you mentioned it as influence before, this kind of personable way to be a leader in like ancestral societies. It rests on the fact that all of these societies were pretty small. I think the limit I saw was like 150 people is like the max number of people that can be coordinated in like a way without coercion or anything, like just based on like knowing everyone and trusting everyone. And, you know, that is possible in these smaller ancestral societies. And you need, it requires a level of like charisma and persuasion and stuff. And so that gets selected for in leadership. But now in like modern days, when you have like giant companies and stuff, the person who's in charge isn't going to be able to like see and talk to and like, you know, actively care about everyone in their company. So, you know, this is the crux of this point that this article was making, is that a lot of leaders sometimes do end up being like high charisma people, and like we want our leaders to have high charisma, but that doesn't really like matter in like a pure number sense, because they're not going to be able to like interact with all of the people that are subordinate to them.
That 150 actually is called the Dunbar number. It's named for biological anthropologist Robin Dunbar, and it's sort of the hypothesized like cognitive limit on the number of people that you can maintain direct and primary friendships with. And supposedly it's based on the ability of like some form of processing in the brain, like neocortical processing in the brain. But among non-human primates, this like the number is like extended to basically the limiting factor is grooming time, because that's how primates, you know, become friends with each other, is grooming.
Right. Yeah. Another thing that is seen a lot in like modern leaders is, according to like evolutionary leadership theory, is this idea of overconfidence. So like we've all seen Zuckerberg on the floor of Congress trying to talk about Facebook. Like you see this idea of like overconfidence occur a lot. And evolutionary leadership theory kind of talks about the point that they make is that in ancestral environments, like having a leader who is confident and even overconfident to a sense isn't that bad, because you could just stop following them once they start being harmful to your group. Because leadership is more like distributed and more situational, if someone starts getting too like full in their head, you can just like stop listening to them, because it was like a smaller ancestral society and someone else can take over. So then it wasn't that big of a deal if leaders are, you know, confident or overconfident. So it kind of selects for that trait over time. But now in like modern settings, leadership is a lot more hierarchical. It's a lot more rigid. And like, if your manager is overconfident, you can't just stop listening to him. Like that's not something that happens. So you end up, you know, according to the logic of this article, you end up getting leaders that are more overconfident and, you know, have aggrandized self-importance, which goes back to what we were talking about in power, like, you know, focusing on your own internal states, not really caring about others. So the evolutionary leadership theory posits this as like a mechanism for that coming about.
That's interesting that there's an excess amount of confidence because there's no adjustment mechanism anymore. We can't just choose to fire our managers.
Yeah, no, there, it talked about in the study, like leveling mechanisms. And like, there was a whole part of the study that was like implications of this. And one of those is like having leveling mechanisms in hierarchies, to where like, if someone isn't being beneficial to the group or is being overconfident in a way, there should be a way to like level the playing field and make it more equitable.
Yeah, just to knock them down a peg or two.
Yeah. Correct. You know, that's important.
Yeah, well, that's important. Also making sure like those mechanisms actually work are important, right? Which I think goes back to norms. I mean, I can't stop thinking about this stuff in like a political sense, you know, because I mean, when you think about like the American system of politics, right? Like the act of being president is like very much a very rigid thing, right? Like you're in there for 4 years, you can potentially run for 8, but there's no real way for a president to be removed other than through like the 25th Amendment or through impeachment. So if both of those, you know, if we can call those leveling mechanisms, if both those mechanisms fail, then, you know, you're really met with this problem where like the executive might be incredibly overconfident. And whether or not those leveling mechanisms succeed is in and of itself dependent on the goal-oriented logic of the actors in question, right? So it's dependent on the cabinet members in the case of the 25th Amendment. It's dependent on members of Congress in the case of
and all these people sit atop their own leadership hierarchies.
Exactly.
Like they are at
exactly.
the top of their own hierarchies. So
exactly. So I mean, the question is like, what are the goals that are being pursued by those people who are both controlled at the levy mechanism, are also like at the top of their own sort of like leadership pedestal, right? So it's really all coming back to norms for me.
Yeah. And for each of those people, I mean, to some extent, they aspire to the higher seat as well. So mm-hmm. they're probably not willing to enforce the norm that limits the power of the office that they aspire to, which is sort of an interesting dynamic there as well. I mean, yeah. In a society where leadership is so fluid, that consideration probably doesn't weigh on people as much because they know their seat in power is temporary, but they'll be governed by their band forever. But that's a little bit more interesting a concept when it comes to like the political system. I know, for example, LBJ, when he was a Senate majority leader, as a Democrat facing a Republican president, was hesitant to limit the war powers of the presidency just because he knew at some point he wanted to hold that position and he didn't want his war powers to be fettered.
Yeah, that that makes me think of like another one of the final like mismatches or just like ideas this paper talked about was this idea of dominance, which kind of relates to what we were talking about in power. So like in like primates and like, you know, not necessarily human modes of like leadership and social interactions, there's almost often a need for various ways of like dominating the competition because like, you know, resources are scarce, mating is scarce, like you need to be able to like make yourself better than the competition and knock the competition down a peg. So, you know, you get these behaviors that are, you know, more selfish, more kind of, you know, less cooperative in any sense. And you get those selected for over time. And then, you know, when you're in a modern era where, you know, it's not really like that anymore, you still have these like vestiges of like previously dominant, overbearing traits. I think that's interesting, like in ties to like the thing that the article mentioned specifically is that one of the ways that humans kind of differentiated from previous groups of animals is the idea that you would, you know, they weren't competing as much for resources within their own group. Like it was you and your band versus everyone else, and you would have to be cooperative to like move to like hunt animals or gather resources or anything. And so this idea of like one of the differentiating factors for, you know, early human evolution is this idea of kind of overcoming previously dominant behaviors and engaging in cooperative behaviors. That was something that was mentioned in this article. And I think that's interesting that like these dominance behaviors still exist and can still be, you know, toxic in the modern world, because you do see a lot of, you know, domineering people and like people doing like selfish things and, you know, corrupt things to gain and maintain power. And this article links that to like older ancestral ways of, you know, dominant traits that maintain your power in like a scarce environment. And that was another thing in this article.
Honestly, Oksana, during that entire time you were just speaking, I could only think about James Harden the entire time.
Yeah, I mean, this study was one of my favorites just because I like evolutionary biology. I like the idea of seeing how like societies and like things in the world now have developed over evolutionary time. But, you know, it talked about implications a lot at the end. And it was a lot of what we talked about before, like having structures of hierarchy that are more fluid, that have more leveling mechanisms. A lot of it is, you know, based in the fact that you need like smaller groups and you can't have like giant groups in that regard. So a lot of it was about kind of, you know, looking to these kind of traditional fluid models of leadership to mitigate some of the harmful effects of leadership. And I found that pretty interesting.
Mm-hmm. Do you guys think that it's possible to adopt sort of like that more fluid situational form of leadership onto like a modern society? You know, because I personally think it'd be like very difficult.
Oh, it definitely would be difficult. I mean, specifically for like companies and like businesses and stuff, like the people at the top like being at the top. So like telling them that at any point we could just level you to be one of us would not be, they would not be fans of that.
I think there's definitely a way to do it, maybe in sub hierarchies. Like, I think ultimately, like firms, governments, et cetera, you need someone at the top for a variety of like security reasons, et cetera, these days, for liability reasons as well for firms. But certainly, like, you know, we have a lot of examples of rotating leadership in the world. Like, for example, at university departments, department chairs, that's a rotating position. Usually someone holds it for a year at most. I think maybe project managers or whatever on a particular task, if it's like a multi-year thing, you know, maybe switching someone out every quarter, every 2 quarters, every year or something like that, that could produce some of the beneficial outcomes by, you know, just changing the structure of leadership a little bit. I think it's definitely possible. Maybe with city states, it might be a little bit more possible to rotate your leader every once in a while. I know, during the founding era, Benjamin Franklin proposed a sort of a committee rather than a single president. But, you know, if we had some sort of committee and maybe someone held like a sort of consul position, you know, every year or so, and you would swap that person out among the committee members, that might maybe introduce some sort of similar, you know, temporary leadership, like fluid leadership dynamic. I think it's an interesting question. I think there's a variety of areas and places and means to sort of implement something like that.
Yeah. I think those are good points. But I think one of the things that make this sort of like this ancestral society idea of leadership so interesting isn't merely the idea that like leadership is being rotated, but also the idea that there's essentially like a level of expertise that's going on, right? So like the person who's best at doing a particular activity is the person who's going to lead in that activity. And obviously they can be like replaced if someone proves that they're better, or, you know, the person who's currently leader acts in a maladaptive fashion, right? And Well, I think that the proposal that you discussed, Parth, that comes closest to that is like this idea of like a committee. Mm-hmm. But even then, if you have like this sort of committee of who are essentially like in a modern society going to be technocrats, right, you do still need like one person who is able to sort of like call out all the information and like call the shots, right? Because all these different technocrats are going to potentially going to like push for like different things.
I mean, you're definitely right. But I think the idea is like, you know, if leadership is rotating so frequently, at some point, like what the technocrats choose, if it's a committee, they'll have to reach some sort of steady state equilibrium. Like they can't keep pivoting from like one extreme to another extreme to another extreme. But I think for a variety of like popular sovereignty reasons, mm-hmm. like it's probably unfeasible to implement something government wide. Like ultimately, like I think it's best to live in a democracy where your ultimate leaders are elected. But at like the lower level, like for something like the FCC commissioner, for example, or the FDA commissioner, mm-hmm. you had like a number of commissioners. And the person who held the chairman seat sort of just rotated freely. I think, you know, that might produce some better outcomes than merely, appointing a single holder.
You mentioned this idea of like avoiding extremes. That is something that is talked about in this study, that this kind of more fluid style of leadership and like kind of, you know, more based on like experience and who is more better equipped for whatever task, it prevents extreme decisions from being made. So I think that fully tracks.
Great. So we solved polarization here.
Yeah. on this podcast. Embrace tradition, reject modernity.
Yeah. Move back to our foraging ways.
Chill there.
Always said agriculture is a mistake, you know?
Hot take to come out on the podcast right here.
You know. Oh, it's not even a hot take, bro. It's contributed to so much so many problems in society. Everything from climate change to like structural like sexism is all due to agriculture.
Wow, why not just put it all on that one tetrapod that left the ocean to join?
Mean, obviously, fuck that guy, but that goes without saying.
You know, part of the proposals that you're talking about really makes me think that we should have like term limits on Supreme Court justices, you know?
Oh, bro, just take it one step further and just have the chief rotate among the associates.
Well, I mean, Okay, like yes, that's like I guess a decent idea, but if we're thinking about in terms of like leveling mechanisms, right? There's no real effective leveling mechanism like on a Supreme Court justice, right? Like there's impeachment there as well, but I think there's only been like a single like Samuel Chase, like a single Supreme Court justice in American history who's ever been impeached. If you introduce like something more like term limits, then there is that sort of like automatic like leveling mechanism where you're only going to be in power for a particular number of years. And you're at least somehow like the composition of the court is at least in a more direct way accountable to the public will than in the current system where, once you're on the court, you're on the court for the rest of your life.
I think
I don't have a strong objection to Supreme Court justice term limits, but I don't think the power creep, like the sort of malicious effect of power, is as prevalent when it comes to the Supreme Court, just because there's nine of them. They all essentially are equals, and the individual decisions of the justices are only so meaningful so long as they are able to bring on a majority of justices. Like Clarence Thomas will have his like crazy ideas about how the world ought to be, but rarely can he convince four other justices that it should be that way as well. So
I
his limits are sort of checked in and of itself.
That's true, I think, but like the influence of a single Supreme Court justice is going to extend beyond like whether or not they can get the majority of a court to side with them, right? Like, for example, things like Harlan's various dissents, they can serve as precedents or like the seed of ideas that are going to be influential later on, right?
Yeah, which is fine. I don't think that the batshit ones necessarily go on to serve as the seeds of like, impressive thinking later in life. I'm sorry we've
You
converted your
never know.
podcast to a We the People session.
I know. I was about to try and bring it back to evolutionary leadership theory.
Well, I mean, it's all connected, We're
It is all
expanding the
connected.
brain.
No,
We're expanding the
what I
brain.
was we are. What I was saying was
Justice Breyer was actually a forager before he was appointed to the Supreme Court, so.
Yeah, that was his job.
what I was gonna say was all like our ideas about like the court and all of this, and I think one of you might have mentioned this in passing, but like a lot of these early societies that were like fewer than 150 people or whatever, even with the leadership structures, they operated on this base of like reciprocity and like somewhat trust in a way, in the sense that you knew that when like Joe from the hut down the river was going to be in charge, like you knew when he was going to be in charge, he would take care of you, so that when you were in charge, you would take care of Joe. Like it was a reciprocal thing where like you wouldn't make any big moves that would hurt anyone really, because you knew that when other people were in charge, you wanted to be taken care of. And that works in like smaller societies when everyone knows each other. But like when you're in like, especially in politics, like the people who are in power rarely ever are like in contact with the like everyone to the extent of the people that their policies have an effect on. So like the whole scale of like an organization of government, of like hierarchy that controls this many people, like mirroring the fluid leadership nature of like ancestral societies is gonna like, I would say that that is like one of the biggest hurdles, if not the biggest hurdle, to like get these ideas in place, is the scale factor.
Yeah, absolutely. They're so isolated from the outcomes of much public policy just because a lot of our politicians do end up being independently wealthy. And so, if they pass an abortion restriction, odds are it's not going to apply to them because they can get the abortion some other means or something like that. An immigration restriction obviously isn't going to apply to them, so they don't have to worry about the outcomes of that sort of action in the future.
Yeah.
I would say like this issue of like scale that you talk about, I think it's very important and very, pertinent. Because this issue of scale, and this increase in like social distance to, go back to something we talked about earlier, it all results in like a decrease in empathy. And I think, assuming that, democracy is something that we find important, empathy is sort of like one of the most important things, I would say, like in like a democracy, right? Like being able to like re relate to your fellow citizen, and not even necessarily like just your fellow citizen, but relate to like fellow human beings and to fellow people in the polis. And I think in our modern day society, where we live in an age of like social media on the one hand sort of like shrinks the scale of distance between everybody, you know, in a sense, like it makes it easier for me to like observe like other people. But at the same time, while like theoretically like social distance might be like narrowing, at the same, it's sort of paradoxical in the sense that social distance is also like increasing as well, because there's this ability to create echo chambers and to more readily form abstractions and stereotypes of other people who you perceive to be in a different tribe from you.
Yeah.
So yeah, that's just my societal comment on.
We live in a society.
Yeah, truly, we live in a society.
No,
sorry for talking
totally
about
valid.
Democracy and stuff, but
it's okay.
I was listening to the Mindscape podcast, and they had Cornel West on there talking about democracy. So, you know, I've been inspired by my brother, Dr. West. You know,
that's a page for you.
Yeah,
I definitely think that's a valid thing to consider, and you know, like to go back to power, which is the main thing that this was about, and like we talked about at the beginning, you know, all of these like studies about like power and like its effects and its consequences are like super important. Like obviously, like there's a reason that we have all of these studies, you know, even though some of them might not be like perfect mirrors in the real world. Like I read like a critique of one study that was talking about how like all of these studies just like prime people with power and they don't actually give people power, but in the real world, like powerful people have power. Like they can avoid consequences and they can make decisions that are selfish because they won't get called out. They won't be leveled for it. So some of these, you know, studies are not super valid compared to the real world because they're just a facsimile of power when in the real world, like people have power. So, you know, despite these like kind of disconnects here and despite any of like the disconnects with like thinking evolutionarily, because we know that, you know, only thinking evolutionarily isn't like the best way to consider, you know, society or anything, like, you know, despite all these disconnects, like is a very important thing to like look at critically from like a scientific sociological like perspective, and you know, it's worth looking at. So I'm glad we did it. We solved it. Those are all the things I had. If anyone has any further thoughts or ideas to summarize, feel free.
I think I'm out of things as well.
Yeah, I really said fuck talking about power. We're going to talk about democracy today.
Christian, 100%. The events of the Capitol riot were weighing heavily on Christian. He just needed an outlet.
Of course.
Well, you know, this podcast is supposed to be, you know, expanding, and we go wherever the guests take us. So.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I think on like our last one, we talked about
today's guest was Christian. In that case.
Yeah. I think last time we ended up talking about like Minority Report and stuff like that, because we were talking about GPT-3, right?
Yeah, we were talking about GPT-3.
And I brought up the whole point that there are like Minority Report-esque things that are happening in cities like Detroit and stuff like that, and how like, you know, AI is like biased and things like that. So yeah,
it happens when we give AI power.
Hey man, don't say bias.
Makes you think.
Say racist.
Makes you think.
AI is racist.
Hey, if you listen to that episode, if you listen to that episode, you would know we did talk about that.
Hey,
oh yeah,
you know I've never listened to an episode of this podcast.